my research, writing and teaching is now done collaboratively with Andrew Metcalf, so it's kind of weird for me to be here by myself, but everything I do is on behalf of both of us. So in a sense, he's sort of with me. A couple of years, and we've now started working on the empirical material from that project. Last year, we both did participant observation in charitable organisations. So this is a case study from that. But I'll start with a little bit of theoretical setting up. And as I did yesterday, I want to apologise for reading some of this rather than talking it, because for reasons of time, it wouldn't be my preferred way of doing it. So the first piece is titled From Gift Exchange to the Gift. And in broad terms, what we're doing in this gift project is raising questions about the reduction of a gift to a gift exchange that is almost universal in the literature across traditions. And instead, what we're interested in doing, I mean, not denying that gift exchanges exist, but if you start with that model, you can't get to what we would think of as a gift proper, which is a gift relation. So what we're interested in, and all of our work, is about relational ontology. So we're trying to think about the gift in relational terms. But this particular paper is set up, is in the focus of this particular paper is care. So it's the gift in the context of care. So it's commonly assumed that the motives of carers influence the quality of care given. There are many who argue that good caring can only take place where the carer's motives are altruistic, where the giver has no desire for returns or rewards. Critics of this view, of course, argue that subjective motives and interests are always involved, that whether conscious or not of it, givers always receive something in return. So that particular debate mirrors the broader debate around the nature of the gift. And most theorists on the gift follow Mauss in assuming that gifts are given by one subject to another and that ongoing social life depends on that. So it's a world of subjects and objects and a sequence of exchanges between them. So hence Mauss says, to give is to show one's superiority, to be more, to be higher in rank, magister. To accept without giving in return or without giving more back is to become client and servant, to become small, to fall lower, minister. Mary Douglas, for example, claims that there should not be any free gifts. What's wrong with the so-called free gift is the donor's intention to be exempt from return gifts. Refusing requital puts the act of giving outside any mutual ties. So that exchange language, it's all within it's a sort of a language of power struggles, equality, conflicts and contracts. And it assumes that the base level is a warlike, if you've read Mauss, is a warlike situation, that there are separate independent parties, and how do they get together? And it's through this sequence of exchanges that kind of a social contract emerges. The focus on the motives of givers has an important place in social analysis, but it involves unrecognised ontological assumptions that make it impossible to understand genuine care. Such care doesn't come from altruistic motives because it doesn't come from motives at all. Whereas the discussion of motives presumes that there's always an acting subject who gives the care to another subject, what we argue is that there are forms of giving that involve no motives and no subjects. That is, we're arguing that the gift isn't always a gift exchange, that they're not always distinct parties who give, receive, and reciprocate. What we're proposing instead is that there are experiences in which there is a giving and receiving that's neither sequential nor locatable. Experiences where giving happens, but not through the volition of any one. In other words, we're making a conceptual space for a gift relation. An experience of grace and gratuity, where there are no distinct givers or receivers. And from that perspective, altruism is no longer impossible or unrealistic, because it arises from the relation itself, which is quite distinct from an interaction or an exchange between subjects. Relational logic is manifest in meetings, whereas an exchange is an interaction between subjects, a meeting is a social form that suspends the time, space, and ontology of subjecthood. We do not meet simply because our paths cross, and do not meet if we see the other in terms of our own desires for identity. Meeting doesn't involve identification or unity, but rather is the experience of simultaneous difference and sameness that cannot be located in terms of insides and outsides. In other words, the space of meeting is infinite. Meetings happen in a here that suspends Euclidean locations and boundaries. A shorthand for that is would be, depends on what works for you, Merleau-Ponty's intertwining. It's quite a different space. To get the feel of what that ontological state is like, it's important to let go of any Euclidean notions of space, which is why we think that the notion of infinitude is a conceptually very rigorous one, and it's important to get that feel of what it's like when you are no longer a distinct subject, that there is that intertwining of inside and outside, and it's not identification. This doesn't work through "I am the same as you." The important thing about meeting is that there's difference, and you can't. It's not identifiable, not locatable. That difference. So this is a non-oppositional logic. To meet is to experience the gift of presence. The time of meeting, therefore, is the now, the non-chronological present, where time is not an abstract measure of life, but is its unfolding. Whereas exchange theory assumes that the subject is the source of the gift, relational logic recognises a gift that arises through the meeting itself. It's gratuitous, gracious, without cause or source. To quote Buber, it occurs through grace. It's not found by seeking. Hence the relation means being chosen and choosing suffering and action in one. A further distinction I want to make between subject-based and relational ontology is a distinction between desire and love. So that love is, we're interested in a relational concept of love. Far from being subjective or personal, love is the responsive way of being that characterises a meeting, not something we do, but a state we're in. So to return to the issue of altruism in care, when we respond through love, we do not do good, but goodness happens. Our responses are what is called for because they don't come from us personally, but from the life of the relation. Far from being the act of a subject, responsibility then is the openness in a relation, a response to a call that is present, coming not from someone and somewhere, but from the meeting. So now I'm going to develop these ideas and get them a little bit more concrete, I'm going to turn to this project, which is on a phenomenology of the gift, and a case study. And this is going to be quite detailed excerpts from an interview. And I think that's important to try and get, so you can get the feel of what I've been speaking about in a rather abstract way. So it's a case study of Sue, a woman who set up a shelter for the destitute. And we came across her just as the coordinator of this centre. It wasn't that we sought her out. It wasn't that we'd heard that she was something special. It was just, this was the, in working out which places we'd do this work in, and this happened to be the basis of mine was going to be a local, what I would do if I was volunteering, my local community centre, and I went in and met this woman. It's a drop-in centre for people who are homeless or have alcohol or drug-related problems. It provides breakfast and lunch 5 days a week for about between 20 and 40 people. It provides places for them to sleep, keep their things, shower, a whole series of sort of services, counselling, legal, and whatever. It's affiliated with a church of which Sue is a community minister, but there is there's a sort of a distance between them, and it relies pretty heavily on the broader community for financial support. On meeting Sue, we were first struck by her good humour, her down-to-earth realism, her lack of piousness. In her early 60s, Sue was open, welcoming and full of life, yet with a calmness that knew all there was to know about pain. She clearly loved the people she worked with, talking of them as if they were her family, giving them hugs, paying full attention to them no matter how busy she was. When we offered to work in the kitchen, she said, "No, I want you to sit and have lunch with everyone else and just listen." Later she explained, "People always want to do something, busy themselves helping, but that creates a distance. The most generous thing you can do is nothing. It makes you aware of your own vulnerabilities." Now, it turned out that that experience of meeting her was matched in accounts by all others, people, other clients, supporters and co-workers, a very diverse group of people. And I haven't really got time to read these comments out as much as I would like to. So some of the people we interviewed were homeless, some were millionaires, and some co-workers. But they all said that with Sue, there were no hidden agendas. She was open and real, and what you saw was who she was. They all remarked on how she made them feel secure, welcome and special, and several of them referred to her as a saint. Their descriptions were of a person who has a calling, and so the focus of this talk is on how she found and refinds this calling. So this is going to be a bit of a longish quote, but just focusing on this, we didn't even get to what her current everyday practice is. This is just the calling. There's a lot more that we can do with this material. So although Sue has lived in suburb all her life and her children grew up here, in her youth she attended an Anglican church in another suburb. When she was 26 and a little bit like a born-again Christian, she was inspired by a sermon about working with your neighbours. She decided to throw herself into church and community activities in her own suburb. "I came down here to the Uniting Church and a lovely old man greeted me at the door. He was so warm and welcoming and I thought, oh, this is a nice place to be. They were all fairly old and I was young, sort of out there with my hand up in the air like some lunatic. There was something that threw me into that church and I don't know what it was, but it was probably to do with the liberated message that was being preached. I'd come out of domestic violence and a breaking marriage, so it interested me that this church didn't frown upon you if you were divorced or anything like that. Eventually, the minister approached me and said, would you be interested in doing 3 days a week as a pastoral worker down here? And I said, I don't know what that is, as I've never done anything like that before. And he said, no, you'd be good at it. Come and join us. At the time, I was still married and I thought, oh, this is a bit risky because I had a mortgage and I needed full-time work. So I went home and talked it out with my husband. He wasn't too keen on it, but I did it and gave up my job working in a kindergarten. So that's how I actually began, just walking on the streets of. I went down to the park, talked to people and just sat alongside them and listened to their stories. Some of them thought I was picking them up. I used to be more attractive in those days. I just looked them in the eyes, people sitting there quietly, and just started chatting. Then I would say, oh, you know, do you want to come back up the road? I work up at the church and have a cup of coffee and a chat. And that's how it started. People used to come up the road with me and sit. We had a little coffee shop at the bottom of the church and we would make a cup of tea and just sit there and talk. In no time I had a group of women meeting there with little children and they were all from fairly broken relationships and broken families. There were also a lot of people with mental illness, people in a pretty bad state that used to wander down into the park coming out of the boarding houses. I'd never had experience with mental health and so I didn't know whether they were telling me the truth and I just sat and listened to their stories. So it was a lot about sitting in people's pain, and that's what it was, sitting in the midst of people's pain and listening and trying to decipher the truth from unreality. So I started two things. One was the women's group, and the other was working with the homeless and disadvantaged in the local area. And it was a bit of an eye-opener to me and a shock because I'd always lived in the area and I hadn't seen poverty there. I just thought, what world have I been living in? Sue became a community activist. She lobbied politicians, fought evictions, held protest marches and rallies, briefed journalists. Journalists exposed the squalor and exploitation in boarding houses. So I sort of built a name then in the area for advocating for people and standing up for their rights and all that sort of thing. At this time, Sue was working from the shopfront rooms of the church. The minister in those days supported me wholeheartedly, but the congregation didn't. They got very uppity about my work. Sometimes when you're employed in a job, what they say and what they want are two different things. My work with the homeless was what they wanted, but when it happened, they couldn't cope with it. I brought the homeless back into the church, and that was really just the end. And because I brought them into their service, into their space, their sacred site, they thought they were going to get HIV or something like that, and they freaked out. It was very painful for me because I was thinking that I was bringing them into a nice place, and this is what the church asked me to do, but there was hostility. The crunch came when they said to me, I think you should go downstairs and have your coffee and tea with them there. This is after the service. That made me ropeable. And I was making excuses all the time for them with the people I was working with. It was a very difficult and very confusing time for me. I left the church for 2 years. I was so angry with them in that they had asked me to do something and I'd done it, and now what's going on? I was a bit disillusioned in my faith as well, and I thought, well, what's all this about? I divorced my husband during that time as well, so everything happened to me all at once, and then the church too. I'd moved out and was living in a little flat. It was very interesting because all of the people that I'd helped, this is very interesting. The church, a lady from my church, came to the door and knocked on the door, and I opened the door and she gave me a box of groceries and left. What I really needed was for her to come in and talk to me because I was in a state and she didn't, she left. But she gave me these groceries, so it was still very nice. Over the next couple of weeks, I had knocks on the door from all the people that I'd helped, that were the drop-in people that I'd given money to and all sorts of things. And they were all coming in and giving me money and giving me bits of furniture. Heard that you were not working and you were here, and they've all been so kind that I couldn't believe it. That made me think about the two, the church and the drop-in people. And then I was walking down in the park and I see them and I say, oh, the church has stopped all my stuff. And so I thought, oh, that's not right. There's a bit of injustice here while I'm going back. The good thing was that because I'd stepped away from it, it gave me time to look at it and think about it. And when I came back, I looked at the church people in a different way. I thought, they don't understand me. And I don't understand them, and that's the way life is. It cleared my thought processes. I thought, not everyone can sit with somebody smelling, but I can. I have to be realistic and think things in a different way in order to do what I want to do. My passion was there, but I knew I had to work this differently. So I went back in, and they said, oh, because I'd changed, of course, not radically, but I was calmer and quieter. And so they employed me immediately again. I hadn't changed, but my view had changed. That's when I started to move out of the church. I felt that if I could get a space a little bit away, they would not be as threatened. The lady whose father owned the local hotel liked what I was doing and offered to put a service charge on the meals so that I could raise the money to get a little property for a drop-in centre. Later, I used to run raffles in the pub on Friday and Saturday nights to raise money for rent. That's where the centre started. So eventually this activity brought Sue to the attention of the local council, which with the church purchased the house where the centre now operates. At the time of our field work, she was in the process of handing the management of the centre over to her deputy, so she doesn't have that need to kind of be hanging on to it. She feels it's the right time to leave. So she's still got some role in it, but she's now moved her focus to another service in another suburb working with women who are involved in domestic violence situations. Anyway, what is calling is the first heading here. So we read this as a story of calling and passion, and there are two terms that she uses interchangeably and others use frequently to describe her. This is my calling. It's something that I feel passionate about. It's within me, you know. That's just me. So in the account above, Sue used the word passion at the crucial moment of her return from 2 years in the wilderness, a period that she described to us as an experience of brokenness. My passion was there, but I knew I had to work this differently. So I went back in and they said, oh, because I'd changed, of course, not radically, but I was calmer and quieter. I hadn't changed, but my view had changed. So her story hinges on the questions that she raises here. What happened to her sense of calling when she stepped away for 2 years? How was this both a change and yet no change? And what did she learn about what passion calls for? So passions are constant, and yet there's a change. And we think that this paradox relates to the tension in the word passion itself. So that it's sometimes associated with obsession, drive, goal-directed energy, and then it's a matter of subjective desire and excess. But by linking her change to a passion that's quiet and calm, she alludes to another and deeper meaning of the word. As its etymology implies, passion has an element of passivity and suffering. In contrast to desire's future orientation, passion accepts and suffers the world. Not emanating from a subject, passion is an energy that's both active and passive. Not something done or chosen by a subject, passion is something received. It's an experience of grace. So what we're suggesting is that passion and calling apply, there's a double meaning in both of these words, and that they can apply both to a subject-based and to relational situations. And so calling can involve willful decision to give your life to a cause, but in its deeper sense, there's no one who's called, no one who calls, and no cause to be called to. In this deeper sense, calling happens in an open relation. It's a simultaneous giving and receiving. These two senses of calling and passion in turn relate to two different understandings of caring. On the one hand, caring understood as the giving of a subject, and on the other hand, caring understood as the grace of a meeting. And what we can see, I'm going to suggest we can too, is see this ontological shift in Sue's, her different experiences of calling from the earlier period to the second one. When she said that there was both a change and no change, what she's referring to is a change in her relation to reality. In that process of that change, she now had the capacity to be in relation with woundedness rather than desiring a changed reality and elsewhere. So calling, in this sense, involves acceptance of what is rather than a call to action. Now, I need to be clear here, particularly in the light of questions that were raised yesterday, that I'm not saying that Sue overcame an inferior form of calling and progressed to a higher form of calling. Okay, and that's really important, because that would be a kind of that linear trajectory. She'd be again be in the activist mode of I've moved on to something better. That's the point about no change, that she actually accepts the reality of the flawed and wounded person she is, and the change is in that acceptance. But there's no claim here that we somehow overcome those desirous subject-based activist or whatever states. It's rather that we can be in relation with them and have some awareness of them. So we don't escape desire, but it doesn't necessarily follow that desire is always present. It's possible for it to be suspended, if you like, when we're in those relational states. Okay, so first of all then, the subject-based care. When Sue first turned up at the new church, she was looking for something new. Something that would free her from the constraints of her old church, the violence of her marriage, and we can presume her own pain. So when the minister approached her with the offer of pastoral work, here was a calling that offered her the chance to remake herself as an advocate for the homeless and disadvantaged. Through her conspicuous zeal and the approval of others, Sue hoped to prove that she was a good person. Having been chosen as the champion of the church, she would take its liberated message to the streets. This sense of calling is characterised by an heroic element, which Hillman and Moore describe in the following way. Social problems waken the rescuing hero who cannot feel content until he has solved all problems, because his very existence depends on slaying monsters, cleaning stables and saving cities. This heroism, Hillman and Moore say, is part of a poor complex. The hero's extrovert activity is a defence against feelings of juvenile weakness, obviating the need to face and suffer, quote, the opaque symptoms that try our souls. Sue would have been both emboldened by the heroic expectations that she projected onto the minister and fearful of her own failings. Out there, for fear of facing her demons, Sue tried to overcome her own sense of weakness by proving herself through good work. So the future was a distraction from the unacceptable vulnerability of the present. Hillman says that one of the main poor characteristics is non-reflective activism. Identity will be won by achieving goals and realising quests. I have to say, in writing this, just it rang true to say for my own history, I guess, in a way, and certainly talking to this person, we've had that sense of a certain kind of shared narrative. Anyway, this seems a fitting description of Sue as she established an identity by leading people into the church, battling with slum landlords, leading protest marches, getting in the newspaper. In all of this, Sue was regarded as altruistic, a person who was selflessly fighting for people who were less advantaged than herself. But of course, she did also have her own personal agenda. Sue's attachment to her identity as activist was revealed in the way she left the church and her pastoral work. Having given the church what she thought it wanted, Sue was indignant when she didn't receive due credit. So here's a clear example of exchange logic. She presumed that if she delivered the outcomes for the people she represented, she'd receive recognition in return. And this concern with recognition suggests that her care for the broken was conditional. And when care is conditional, it involves judgments. Judgments of what is and what is not acceptable. And that's exemplified in her description of the crunch when the congregation sent her downstairs out of their sacred site. And she ascribes this to the disgust that the church community had for the homeless, whom they claimed to love. The homeless were excluded because they endangered the purity of the church. But of course, her own reaction kind of mirrors that same exclusionary process. So her reaction was in turn disgust at the narrow-mindedness and hypocrisy of the congregation. So she replicated their exclusions. Her disgust shows that her previous high regard for the churchgoers was based on a fantasy of their being perfect, and she was not accepting them as they were. When they failed as good Christians, this reflected on her identity, which could be protected only by denying a relation with them. She couldn't forgive the church people because she couldn't forgive herself. Her shame in having been associated with non-Christian behaviour was a claim that such behaviour was beneath her, that she was better than this and better than others. To forgive herself would have involved acknowledging that she was no better than others, that she could be accepted as the flawed person she was. So that the judgmental attitude that Sue had toward the church people and herself, of course, affected her relation with the homeless. In choosing not to judge them, curiously, in a kind of way, she was revealing in a way that in some ways she expected or thought less of them. So this lack of expectation gave the relation a tinge of the asocial quality that Maus identified when discussing gifts with no requital. Meant to minister to the homeless, Sue had, in Maus's terms, put herself in the position of magister, someone who can rise above the need for return. Sue identified herself as a representative of the homeless, voice of the voiceless, the goodness of her actions deriving from her apparent altruism. This selflessness, however, was a claim that she didn't really belong with this group. Accompanying them made her look good to the community because she was not one of them. Thus, there was, in fact, a disguise desire for return to the self. So she left the church, she left the homeless. In leaving the church, she denied her own failure to forgive. In leaving the homeless, she denied her own pain and brokenness. In leaving everything behind, she acted upon her activist desires that had led her into the church. The church had offered her the fantasy of a fresh start, leaving it offered her the opportunity of a neat conclusion. Both actions involved the denial of the present and the fantasy of closure on the past. But whereas the earlier case involved the fantasy of arriving, the latter case offered there was nowhere to go. And that's the crucial thing, that there was nowhere else for her to run to. She was kind of stuck then, and in that process of stuckness, something could happen. Just before I leave this discussion of her early career, it's important to note that it doesn't all fit the model of the social activist. When she describes being sitting quietly with people in the park, there's something else going on there. She's not then identifying them as homeless. And there's a capacity there to just be with people, whoever they are, without that identificatory process. And that mode has now become the mode of her vocation since this. Okay, so now I want to turn to what's happened in the shift, relational care. So her story pivots in on the 2-year period of confusion and loss in which she lost her church, marriage, job and her faith. She withdrew from the world, closed in a little flat, closed in on herself and her suffering, cowering under and railing against the blows of life. Decisively in this broken condition, she could no longer sustain a fantasy of bouncing back or overcoming adversity. And so this offered the opportunity for an acceptance of reality. Far from recovering from brokenness, Sue emerged from this period when she realised she'd been broken all along and would never recover. The period of brokenness ended when it became clear that it wasn't just a period, but was the human condition. So she could then relinquish fantasies of perfection and accept the weaknesses in herself and others. As Hillman says, this form of change is very different from the heroic model of fixing and overcoming. He describes it as a shift from weakness and suffering to humility and sensitivity, from bitterness and complaint to a taste for salt and blood, from a focus upon the emotional pain of a wound, its causes, perimeters, cures, to its imaginal depths. A particular wound, Hillman says, takes one into the archetypal condition of woundedness. What changes is not the basic cry, the wound, but our connections with those places and our reflections through them. The wound opens us. It becomes, as Hillman says, the eye through which we gain compassion and insight. This is the shift that Sue experienced. I hadn't changed, but my view had changed. Ontologically, Sue was now in relation with the world, open rather than defended and defensive. So her change was a recognition of the changeless. So what she found in this, when she was in the world, and she had nowhere to go, but she found the world coming to her. And you notice, even in the retelling that story today, there's a sense of wonder as she does it. You can feel she's back in that space, and she's amazed at the process that went on. Throughout her interviews, not just those bits I read, but throughout them, she spoke of knocks on the door. And we really like that as, well, it's not just a metaphor, it's a kind of, there's something real, literal about that metaphor. As a charity fundraiser, she's well aware of the vulnerability of those who knock on the door. You get a lot of rejections, she said, abuses, abuse, doors slammed in the face. So it reminds us then that when the church people and the homeless were coming to the door to make offerings to her, they were making themselves vulnerable. She could have knocked them back again when she was in that hurt and defensive, you know, state, like, oh, don't come near me, you know, all that kind of that funny mode one can get into. But she opened the door, and in doing so, opened herself and let go of that defensive independence. In other words, her receiving at that moment was a giving. In opening the door, Sue met vulnerability. The unbelievable kindness she mentioned was not a surfeit of objects held out to her, but the lack of defences of those at the door. This explains why, in her account, the homeless and the church become interchangeable. So what's going on here is she's no longer identifying people, church people, homeless, What there is instead is what she's meeting is everyone in their naked vulnerability and realising then what destitution means. This isn't an identity characteristic, but rather the state that connects us all. And so in meeting that vulnerability, she's meeting, of course, her own vulnerability. This isn't a sort of a subject category that relates to particular groups or classifications. It's a primal, what she's meeting there is a primal woundedness. When Sue opened the door then, it would have been difficult for her to identify which side she was on. Was she inside or outside, the giver or the receiver? Was the door an exit or an entry? Was she host or was she guest? The thing about the open door is it shows that opposing terms are always implicated in each other, that strangeness is always also on the inside. Sue was thus in a liminal state, between positions, in both positions, in no position. In this state, she experienced an infinite tenderness, infinite in the sense that it would have been impossible to locate or to distinguish if the tenderness was wound or compassionate response. So she was meeting her own vulnerability as she met that of others. These liminal experiences are not only moments of suspended Euclidean space, but moments that suspend linear time. The people at the door were those whom Sue thought she'd left behind, but here they were, emissaries carrying news of a past revealed in a future that's already present. They had returned, or more accurately, they'd never left Sue, and Sue had never left them. What she thought she'd rejected was nevertheless given. Despite having put so much energy into the decision to leave, this choice turned out to be insignificant, effortlessly set aside. In that liminal moment, Sue experienced the stillness that reveals truths masked by subjective choices and desires. So in facing that reality then, there's no longer a question of choices. That something just happens, that something's called for, that isn't a matter of the subject's willfulness or choice. I want just briefly to mention that throughout her interviews, she spoke about love. I'm aware of the time moving on, and the importance of loving these people. And it was clearly an impersonal and unconditional love that she's talking about. I'm just going to read a quote, because I think this does relate to the question of the response that she had. When I was broken as a person, I remember I was in church. The thing that I experienced was a sense of love, of being loved by something higher that you don't know. I think that it's a bit of a responsibility when you've had that experience to actually share it with somebody. So in a lot of ways, I think that my ministry is a sort of love. It's looking at somebody and allowing them to sense that I love them. I'm having hard work saying what I mean. But when someone really loves them and cares what happens to them, it doesn't matter what they are. I don't care who you are. I love you and I care about what's happening to you. So when she speaks here of the responsibility that comes with love, she's referring to calling in a relational rather than subjective sense. At the door, her sense of calling returned, but as if for the first time. It was deeper, calmer. Calling no longer involved the activist urge to do something for someone, because in this stillness there was no one and nowhere else. What has to be done happens in the call and response of the meeting, for to hear the call is to have responded. So call and response are gift terms. It shares that same logic, spontaneity and simultaneity of giving and receiving. And you'll notice that the directness and immediateness of her response is then matched by when she returns to the church. In a sense, the door is opened in the same way with that oh, the wonder of that oh, and they directly, there's no question about will they or won't they have her, won't they have her back. So again, it's that kind of the meeting of what we'd see as a gift relation. The call and response is immediate and direct. What happened when in her return, notice that she says she accepts the church people for who they really are. She accepts difference unconditionally. We're not the same. We are different. She's not trying to resolve differences there. So she had learned acceptance and that was the gift that brought forgiveness. Most importantly, with the openness of the door, she'd learnt to accept her own limitations and failings. So, in a way, what we can say then is that her calling and her capacity to give come from the acceptance of brokenness, which explains why people say that she has no hidden agendas, what you see is who she is. In a sense, her brokenness or woundedness is her calling. So I'd better kind of wind up. But what I'm trying to suggest there is that you can see, and when she's in that subjective state, you can see that altruism certainly does involve that sense of there is a kind of a desire for return involved. There was something about her identity very much at stake in that early period of her life. But in the later period, the care of the other is happening through the meeting of self and other, in which it's not possible to define self or other. Giving comes from the relation rather than the subject. So it's altruistic, selfless, because all participants simultaneously give and receive without it being possible to identify which is which. Okay. Thanks. Sorry, I'm sorry I went on.
No, thank you. Okay. Thank you, Anne, for such a wonderful presentation. Let's open it up for discussion.
I think that this is, that was just a thought that came to us as we were writing that, and I think what we were trying to get at was that maybe, so that this is perhaps, it is a rite of passage, but it would involve then, in the light of this logic, rethinking the way it's usually thought of. I mean, I'm not an anthropologist, but I'm assuming that it would generally be regarded as a step, it's a step on the way to somewhere else, which of course is not a logic that we're talking about here, because we have a different kind of temporality involved. It's like it's as if liminality is what is was always there. There's a past and future in it, and so that it's something about that liminal state that Sue now lives. I mean, yes, in a way, it is an opening to something else, but it's not in that linear way of that kind of a trajectory, which is, I think, isn't that the way liminality is usually understood, that it's kind of one stage on a path to something else. I guess actually, now you're making me think about this, when we're talking about her shifting from a poor state to a state of maturity, in Hillman is a sort of a Jungian psychotherapist, I perhaps should have said that and more. He would never see that as a kind of, you know, he doesn't like any notions of what he calls resurrection fantasies. So it's not that, you know, you kind of start off being immature and then you kind of progress to maturity. What maturity is a recognition that we always remain and bear those, our kind of poor kind of complexes. So it's kind of a bit tricky, logic, isn't it? Because it's so easy, I can see myself, it's so easy to kind of fall into, there's some kind of development has happened. I don't know if that answers your question, Rob. There might have been more to it.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a rite of passage, but suspension.
Yeah, a suspension maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks.
I wanted to address the question of the understanding of the self.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was just wondering that for her understanding of the self, there would have to be necessarily the dependence on the other at some point in time. And it's only a recognition at a point in time that there is no difference between the self and the other. But otherwise, I mean, you know, generally in the rest, but generally in the modern intellectual traditions, you have this very narcissist understanding of the self.
Yeah.
Whereas here, I mean, you know, she's moving away from that.
Yeah.
Recognition emergence of the dependence on the other to understand the self?
Yes, but what I'm trying to get away from, well, make a distinction between a kind of, an Hegelian understanding of a self-other relation, which I would say has dominated most post-structuralist thinking. And people often think, and what post-structuralists like about that, they say, oh, it's terrific because there's another. Okay, so there's some kind of relation going on here. But of course it's oppositional and identity based. So the other is only there as the mirror to reflect back onto the self. What happens in the moment when one is truly in relation with the other is there's no longer it's a different ontological state, so that you can't identify where that otherness is. At that moment, at that open door, and that's why I think an openness of a door kind of really helps. Otherness is simultaneous. It's not sequential. It's not, oh, I see someone at the other side of the door is vulnerable and weak. Oh, hence sympathy. Hence, I'm vulnerable and weak. Something simultaneous happens there that you can't identify where the strangeness is. The strangeness is simultaneously inside and outside. And that's the relation with otherness then. So it's why I'd want to put, say, self and other all at once. So that, if you like, a kind of a recognition of who you are is a recognition of your of a non-identity state, of an undefinable difference that can't be contained. And hence it is a state of surprise and wonder about oneself. So the other side to that would be a notion of potential, of always being surprised by oneself in moments of meeting. And it doesn't, of course, necessarily have to be with other people. It's, you know, in those meetings with the world, or meetings with texts, or, you know, there would be that kind of uncanny, strange and familiar self and other at once. But a sense of, I know this, I've always known this. Now I recognise, I think what she would have felt is, now I recognise what's always been there. So, you know, just early on when she said something like, when she saw the destitute at the park, she said, where have I been? Where have I been all my life? Now, at that stage, she would have seen that in identity terms. Oh, golly, there are people who are homeless here. But I think that probably in reliving that moment, she'd say, what haven't I seen all the time that was there all along, which is my vulnerability.
So what you're saying is, at point in time when there is a recognition.
Yes, I am saying that.
Yeah, right, but there are the stages. Right?
There is a point of time, but at that point of time, what happens at that point of time is that it then suspends linear time. What that point of time is it takes you into a time which is the eternal. Yes, but so you have both, yes, of course, both times, just as both forms of space, finite and non-finite, linear and the eternal, of course, coexist.
I think actually Sarah and then Sharon and then... Oh, sorry.
I might end up asking Rob and Aloka's question over again in a different way. But and before I do, I just wanted to say that I really, really enjoyed the way in which you were bringing an empirical case study together with your theoretical reflections and so on. But I guess it's like a cluster of questions in a way. And you just made this distinction between, or you said it's not time, linear time, but eternal time. Mm. And of course, the question that sort of chased the other questions away when you said that was, why is it either or? Why would it be eternal time or linear time is the only two possibilities? Because the question I was going to ask you is that, insofar as you're interested in a new ontological construction, a relational ontology, and so on, the question that raises for me is, how do you handle the historical, the historicity of the categories by which you're working, right? The categories through which you're working, the historical conditions of possibility of the experiences, the narratives that you've collected, the conditions of possibility. vulnerability of those are all historical and social ones, right? And in trying to put together a new ontology, sort of pulling it out of a hat or constructing it out of whatever you're constructing it out of, those narratives in particular, it would seem to me that either you have some way of being able to understand that both the historical ground of that ontology, or else are you not, say, for example, in the interpretations that you make, there's a whole set of Christian resonances, like love, for example, is the category that you talk about. You talk about the moment of grace and so on. As social scientists, social theorists in the world today, should we be worried about those kinds of those kinds of meanings in the narratives that we're
Okay, well, there seem to be several questions there.
Yeah.
First of all, I wondered if one of the questions is about is something to do with what how people hear me speaking about the eternal. Maybe this comes back to what I understand our phenomenological method doing. I think of it as one way of talking about relationality is as a holistic approach. And the way into getting a feel for the whole is through the part. And so what Andrew and I emphasise in all of our work and our teaching of students is the particular. So that in talking about, we're interested in the universal and the particular. We'll make a distinction between that and usual sociological modes, which involve generalisation and abstraction, where you are not close to the specificity of it. So what we would say is through considering the particularities of space and time, and what we would try to do and encourage all our students to do is give very, very detailed accounts of what is the experience of time and space in this particular instance. And through that, one can get a feel for something that one might think of as the whole, but always emphasising the particular. And the only way it would work, the only way I think that would have worked today was if, which is why I had to read so much, was if you could feel something, this would be a phenomenological method, if you could feel something of what I was talking about. So I don't know if that partly answers your question. The other one that is what you're raising is the question of the apparently Christian concepts that run through this, and they are Christian, but they're not only Christian. They come from various traditions, and one of the project that Andrew and I are now moving into is on the sacred in everyday life, and we are explicitly wanting to raise questions about the ways in which social theorists think about the sacred and religion. And we find it very interesting, the kinds of responses that people often have to our work. They say, "Are you Christian? And is there God lurking somewhere here?" Now, the thing about our the concepts we're using here, the key one that I didn't use here would be the one of, which would be no thingness, or another concept for destitution would be no thing, would be emptiness. And I guess what we'd say is that those sorts of concepts you can find in a range of different kinds of, in different religious traditions. So we're quite unapologetic about our interest in religious terms and wanting to bring them to life, that experience of grace. I think that rings true for us. Notions of gratuity is something that we particularly, this paper didn't focus on it, but it's something that we've done in other papers, and recently written one on the religious sign and the gratuitous nature of it, which I think is shocking in a way to social scientists, that notion that something just means. Mm? It doesn't mean anything. It means nothing. Mm? It just means. Mm? And there is no cause. It is absolutely right. It is absolutely meant. And yet it's absolutely fortuitous. There is no causality to it at all. And that's what I understand by a religious sign or by something religious. Mm? It's something that eludes our traditional social science ways of thinking and our ways of thinking, usually in terms of notions of causality. So I don't know if that answers.
Well, hang on. Can we go? I think
maybe
we've got two others,
sure.
And we're mindful of the time. I'm sorry, we might have to wait. So can we start with you, Sarah, and then we'll go to Jen?
I'm wondering if there's something, whether you think there's something in particular about the destitute or destitution that lends itself to the kind of theorizing of the gift and population that you're doing. If you'd be going to a child care center, an employment assistance center, or a diabetes association, or something else, do you think that you would have found the same kind of narratives or been able to read them in the same way? What is it about destitution?
I think you probably could, but the thing about this is that it's really confronting in a way. I don't know if people know Sayre's book, Angels, but he starts with, it's called Angels, a Modern Myth, and he starts with an image of homeless people. And we sometimes give that to students, and of course we do on Living and Dying, and we get them to write about it. And they have to use identity categories to deal with it. They have to think of it in terms of, what I'm saying is I learn a lot from this. What do you do when you're faced with a homeless person in the street and all of those kinds of, you know, I want to help, what do I do to be a good person, you're feeling uncomfortable and awkward and whatever. And their writings about this image of a homeless person in Sayre's book betrays all of that. Mm? And it's quite hard for them to get from identity characteristic to, oh my God, what I'm facing is myself, in a way. It's really deeply shocking. And I have to say, when I was doing this, this field work, I found it very confronting myself. I mean, I've kind of erased that a bit from it. But all of this was going on for me because I kind of knew, in a way, what would be the correct way to be responding. Mm? But it was a confronting experience, and I'd have glimmers of how Sue was, and realised that the way we've described her in that second half is truly how she is. She truly loves these people in an unconditional way, and I was trying to spend a lot of time trying to imagine my way into that state. But I also suspect that it is something. It's always going to be something about. What's at stake here is my own woundedness and what I can face or not when I'm in it. Yes, I think probably you would find it in other ones, but this it did provide, and we didn't know it was going to be what we were going to be doing research on, and we didn't know it was going to be the first thing we'd write out of it. This is what the material asked us to write once we started to look at it. Of all of the interviews and things, we thought, this is what's calling for analysis. Hmm? And I haven't quite, I know I haven't answered that, but.
But I
will keep thinking.
The particular in the whole that you're talking about, what does it mean that it's destitution in particular?
Yeah. You might be right about maybe there is something particular about this experience that does that leads you into that in a way that others mightn't so directly. I mean, I don't know if people can imagine it, but this is quite a confronting situation to be in. And when she, you know, I love cooking. I said, oh, you know, no, my old activist mode, I'll get in the kitchen and do this and that. No. I mean, to sit and eat, and I'm someone who loves eating meals, but to be sitting eating with these people every day was quite hard for me.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, I teach a graduate course, and some of the students who are here in that question, there's lots of resonances in what you're talking about, what we were grappling with yesterday. And one of the questions we were grappling with was this question of openness in this ontology of relationality.
Yeah.
And the specific context in which we're thinking about this is in relationship to the violent and dead. And so it strikes me as you're talking that it's the relation of ontology that actually keeps you open.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the context I work in, the relationship is with the dead.
Mm.
So you don't get the same sense of the nourishment of the openness in the relation, right? Or maybe you do, this is what I'm wondering about. So are there other relations that need to sustain that relation that Sue's in?
That's a good question.
So, is there something that you could speak
yeah.
to?
Okay. Well, one of the by the way, she's read this because of course we wouldn't, do anything with it publicly before she. And she kind of, she said it was mind blowing, but she really, really, found it really interesting. She said this is the sort of language she'd use. This is really part of her journey, I think that the minister actually may be in part, we asked, it's not here, but we asked her that question a lot. People would say it's amazing she doesn't burn out. Why is it that other people around, you could imagine this, it's incredibly stressful work. So she finds a way, obviously, to provide, to do that kind of holding relation, with herself in part, but not just with herself. So she would be what people would call boundaried in the sense of, be careful about how she goes to work, having her coffee on the way. Very good at saying, no, this can wait. She doesn't just say yes to everything. So when the neighbours are all ringing about, all the drunks being, in their back front yards and things and this and that, she just say, this is other co-workers said this to her, Sue can just say, no, that can wait. She knows how to do that. She's not overwhelmed by it. She's very careful about her private life. So had weekends to herself. But I actually think that the minister, I think that he is still with her now. In fact, he's now offered her a church that's become non-consecrated. The Uniting Church is kind of disappearing in Australia, and so she set up his new centre. For women in this fabulous space. And I said, oh golly, is he still around? And she said, when she was telling me this, and she said, yes. And I thought, he's there. I suspect that he's just been there in that steady way. I saw him a couple of times when he turned up at the sets. In that steady way, he's just there. She would do all of her number of kind of running off and coming back and this and that. And there he was, that he had a sense. He could, if you like, he could see her potential. She spoke a lot about seeing people's potential. But he could see hers, and he could be patient while she was doing all of her, finding her way and things. But yes, I think so. But as with but remember, even to as with the dead, she finds nourishment. Remember, in this, I wouldn't want to underestimate that there is a giving in this, that she needs it.
Okay, well, look, I'm mindful of the time, and I know that Ipak does have a question, as does Amy. There are two ways to go here. Are you okay now
to take...
if you can keep your questions brief, that would be great, and then maybe we can deal if anybody has to go, and then we'll hand over to you to just say fine. Thanks. Okay, so.
Thank you very much for the talk, first of all. And then my question is, the ontological schema you're suggesting is how we can ethically engage with this very calling or the very passion. Like, when you were talking, I was thinking about, sorry, I need to keep it short. What if this passion, passion is fascistic? Or what if this, how we will judge that difference? Like, in this relationship, what is, will there be a crack that we can see and see the calling? Because you're assuming that your relationship with the homeless is a good deed. And what I see is that, and what is striking for me is that you said there is no way out. There is no way out because this person is believing that what she's doing is good and she can't really, I of course agree with these constitution of the subject in that relational schema.
Sure. Okay, I'll answer that question. I was finished with the thing about different understandings of goodness, which I left aside. And I'll say on that, my favourite person on goodness at the moment is Iris Murdoch, and her book, there is without goodness without God. Is it? That's a terrific. That's a terrific book. It's called The Sovereignty of Good. But her main thing is about how to get the self out of the way. The veil of how can the veil of selfish consciousness be pierced so that we join the world as it really is. And that goodness has nothing to do with the self. So, okay, but I understand the question you're asking. We, in terms of that call and response, I did this more explicitly yesterday, but what we would draw on is Martin Buber's ethics, and that's what I have in mind here. And in a sense, of course, you know, it's not a question of there being guarantees, but that it's what feels. I can only put it like this: it's what feels right. It's kind of that this is called for. It's not about having some external, you know, kind of this is good and this is bad. In fact, what it involves is a recognition that the bad and good are always implicated in each other. And it's about having some kind of faith that if you are honest in hearing, if you are present to hearing the call, the response, there will be a goodness in that meeting, which is the call and response. I suspect that when there is, if you want to put it in terms of evil involved, it's going to come back to something which would be something to do with identity, or another way to put it would be in terms of idolatry, to answer your question. And of course the problems with religions as organisations, whatever, you know, fundamentalism or whatever, they're problems of idolatry. But people who reject religion are similarly engaging in it, often in idolatrous activities of projections of the human into that idolatrous space. So for me, that space, which is sometimes referred to as the divine or whatever, is precisely what guards against idolatry or humanist fantasies or identity fantasies. So it's in fact it's the subject, it's the self, it's humanism that gets in the way of an honest or what we think of as goodness in our responsiveness. Once the self, when you think of responsibility in terms of being self-responsible rather than Buber's response, it's that self-responsibility that gets us into trouble. Am I not answering this very well? I suspect that things like something like fascism, you will find that there is some unity, some identity involved there. That there is a cause. And then when you're in that mode of doing something for a cause, an identity, a unity or whatever, then you're out of that directness of the presence to the reality of this situation and what does it call for.
I should just say that Anne did agree to speak in the lounge, the graduate lounge, afterwards, so we can meet up and continue this very important conversation, no doubt. Amy, is it a brief statement,
yeah.
or do you want to continue it down? No, just brief.
Okay, I'll be brief. I wanted to ask about the language and the ideas of passivity and acceptance.
Yeah.
And I was actually going to ask whether or not that language emerged out of Sue's particular, you know, who she was in her story, or whether it reflected your kind of commitment on your part to a certain kind of this love ontology. Now I hear from your answers to Sarah and Sarai that it's obviously both.
It is both. And the thing is, as much as possible, we want the concepts to emerge, you know, from the work and not to be imposing them. But of course, there is a relation between it. And yes, of course, acceptance is one of the key terms that we like.
Well, what I want to ask about, and I want to thank you actually for naming that this conception of love is a Christian one.
Yeah.
Is about the other side or another element to that love. Passivity, acceptance is part of it, but I also see, even in Sue's story, the destructive quality, mm-hmm. an annihilating, sort
mm-hmm.
of obliterating, and
yeah.
and
yeah.
violent
yeah.
aspect,
yeah.
which is not necessarily to say bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And even on the level of,
yeah.
you know, to change her relation to herself sort of changes everything in how she is in the world.
Yeah.
So I guess just what do you make or how do you reconcile, what place do you see for that destructive, violent,
yeah.
obliterating aspect of well love and but particularly the Christian?
Well, I guess that it's partly what I was just saying is that I mean the notion of implication is what I think really kind of is what works for me. This isn't a notion. I don't want to get back into oppositional thinking and somehow as if one has arrived at the good. This is not kind of, you know, a goody-goody story. This is about accepting, you know the violence that we're capable of, all the awful black, you know, shadow stuff that goes on. It's once you start saying no to that I'm a good person and I'm not that. That's when the problems set in. So I'm not an expert on Christian theology, but what I would say about the kind of love that we're interested in is one that acknowledges that implication, that I'm implicated in evil. I have to say that Sayre book on angels is very good on that stuff too. People are interested in it. That we can't, you know, that you can't wriggle around it and put yourself in that position of being the judge. Hmm?
Is that violent aspect can you even say it's a bad thing?
No.
Is it accepting it or is it?
It's accepting it.
There seems to be an active taking. You know, there's a passion for suffering, a pleasure or a desire for it as well, which isn't to say it was just no criticism.
Yeah, well, but there would be, I guess that the point is it would be about accepting that aspect, wouldn't it, of oneself, hmm? Of that kind of, yes, that rings true in a way, isn't it, that kind of getting into suffering, hmm? Which is very different from an acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And even just in changing your relationships to the world, I mean, something
yeah.
dies and something else is born.
Yeah.
And so something has to be destroyed.
Yes, it does, yeah.
I'm going to have to
yeah,
say, this
right.
is brilliant, and
yeah.
it's a wonderful way to begin our SIPs, and I encourage it all, and I want to thank you all for it, but more importantly,
yeah.
I want to hand over to Suzanne to offer the final word
oh.
of thanks. So.
Oh,
so, yeah, so I have a great
to
pleasure
that.
To thank Anne for the gift of thought and the gift of contemplation, and I know that there's an opportunity to continue this, but I really appreciate you coming, and I appreciate Rob Shields organizing this series of events. And for inviting Women's Studies to be able to co-sponsor this event. So thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
I also want to use this opportunity to kind of plug our speakers. You may indulge me for. So I brought posters, and
wow.
I want to invite you next Thursday at the 16th of October. Aloka Parasha Zen is actually going to give the first lecture in the series. She is talking on Thursday about interrogating gender in early India, notions of feminine identity. And it's also our opportunity to welcome her to the University of Alberta because she just joined
a
us.
A continuation of the self and the other.
So please come out. I have some posters. Pick them up, hang them up, and I hope to see many people again next weekend.
Thank you.